This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and to entertain you a little along the way. This episode, the EPA is preparing a proposal concerning leaded aviation fuel, a next generation LAV, restraints for infant safety in flight, Ryanair's Learjets, a sudden West Coast ground stop, FedEx wants lasers on some aircraft, more badly behaving passengers, will it ever end, and a TFR bust that involved an F-15. We also have an airline story, you might call it a customer service story from Brian Coleman, and a conversation with Brett Snyder, the cranky flyer and cranky concierge. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 687 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first Rob Mark. He's contributing editor to Business and Commercial Aviation, part of the Aviation Week group, and he's publisher at jetwine.com.
Hey, listen, Max from Chicago, welcome to everybody. And if I haven't said this before, did you ever notice how Max's voice kind of goes up when he says, "Welcome to the Airplane Geeks"? Like, no one is more surprised that this technology works than he is. But
it's a shock.
You guys had to be here before we started.
Also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian from the American Helicopter Museum.
Hello, everybody. Looking forward to a laughter-filled evening, because if the pre-show is anything, this is going to be a very unique episode.
Yeah, the pre-show is a classic. Also with us, another classic, Mr. Max Trescott, host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. I was flying in an aircraft today, and 5G was turned on, and thank God the plane landed. So, you know, otherwise I wouldn't be here.
Oh, yeah. We don't have any stories, I don't think, in the lineup on 5G, although I see it's made the national news in a big way.
Oh, yeah, and there was more news today, so yeah, we'll have to just mention
that. Yeah,
they're
taking another hiatus.
Yeah. Yep.
David, is it going to be like the tanker stories, do you think?
I don't know. You hang around another 10 years, and we'll see if we're still talking about it.
Oh, I hope not.
I hope not, too. Well, listen, we did have a guest, but at the last minute, we had to shift the recording of this week's episode one day. I had a bit of a family emergency, and family comes first, of course. But Brett Snyder was scheduled to be our guest. Unfortunately, he had another commitment today, so we have, or we'll have to reschedule him. It turns out Brian Coleman caught Brett at that same commitment, at least I think it was, and they recorded something that will slip in later. That'll all make sense when you hear it, I hope. But first, we've got some news from the past week. Are you guys all ready?
Ready from the West.
Heck yeah.
Ready.
First story comes from the EPA. I guess this is a press release. EPA to evaluate whether lead emissions from piston engine aircraft endanger human health and welfare. Well, the EPA administrator, Michael Reagan, has said EPA has been investigating the air quality impact of lead emissions from piston engine aircraft near airports for years, and now we're going to apply that information to determine whether this pollution endangers human health and welfare. Rob, I guess this has kind of been building.
We've been hearing about this for almost as long as it's been since. Let's see, when did they knock out leaded fuel in automobiles?
76, 77.
All right, so long time, 50-some years ago. But we've been hearing about this for a long time, but the EPA has never done anything. And now they're saying, we're going to take a look, and I don't know how soon it'll be before they come up with their findings, but they could come up with a rule that says after 2027, there's no more lead fuel in anything. And, you know, the people in general aviation that have been working on it. And we've had we've talked about these pioneers a couple of times. They're going to have to get their butts in gear, or there's going to be a lot of airplanes that aren't going to be flying.
Well, they haven't been doing nothing. They did come out and they
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound like they were doing nothing, because there were some pioneers there, but
Well, you said in the past they haven't done anything. And what they did is they went out to Let's go back to the videotape.
I'm sorry. I meant the EPA. I meant the EPA hasn't done anything.
Okay. So let me tell you what they did. About three to 4 years ago. About 3 to 4 years ago, they went out to, I believe it was about 17 airports, GA airports around the country, and they put in monitors, sensors to detect how much lead was coming out of aircraft. Now, they did that at one of the airports I fly out of, which is the San Carlos Airport in Northern California, and they put the monitoring equipment right next to the run-up area. So they went and found the absolute highest concentrations. And so, of course, they detected lead coming out of these airplanes doing their run-ups at significantly high power. And so the net result was some signs went up on the fence that basically, you know, warned people, hey, there's lead in this area. And then they moved the run-up area probably about 150 feet so that it wouldn't blow into a parking lot for an office building that was adjacent to the run-up area. But they've done some other things. They had a report out in 2016 that said that piston engines were the single largest source of airborne lead. Also, I saw in another article here that all other leaded fuel sources were phased out in 96 under the Clean Air Act, and that overall, this is pretty amazing, airborne lead exposure in the U.S. has fallen 99% since 1980. So I think the target has moved pretty much to small airplanes. And I have a theory on this. I think part of it is that since the new unleaded fuel, the G100LL, that got certified last summer is now available.
You mean UL?
UL. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, G100UL. I think that now there's probably a path forward where they can say, all right, we're going to ban this without suddenly grounding 150,000 airplanes. So it kind of makes sense from a timing standpoint.
Sure, it does. And of course, you know this better than anybody, that the unleaded fuel that we've been talking about works. It will work in most of the GA airplanes, except when they get into the higher horsepowers, say six cylinder engines, I don't know, maybe 250 and above, which look at Cirruses, Bonanzas, Barons, they're all going to get whacked. So that means everything's going to have to speed up if the EPA comes down with any kind of recommendation for final action. And, of course, there will be an awful lot of back and forth debate and yelling and screaming and all that before it's instituted. But could be an interesting couple of years.
Well, GAMI has done the testing, which has shown that now the high-performance airplanes that you're talking about can actually use the G100UL. The FAA asked them to roll out the SDAs, the certifications, you know, at a staggered basis so that they all didn't come out at one time. But it does sound like they've finally solved that problem for the large
piston. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Ooh, when did that happen?
I saw something about this, last fall.
What about for warbirds?
Good question. I mean, I know that what they did when they're testing is that they tried to take all of the corner points, the corner cases, and they tested the fuel against all the corner cases. And so then based on that, they were able to infer that all of the other engines in between these corner cases would work. I just don't know how large an engine they used. I mean, some warbirds are pretty massive engines. I just don't know if they did Mustang P-51 engine testing.
Right, that's exactly what I was thinking of is the Mustangs, but there are certainly others.
Well, okay, this is me being a historian and a dork and not knowing what the hell's going on. But for cars that used to run on leaded gas, there's additives that you can put in the unleaded gas so it pretends to be leaded. Can't we do that for aviation engines?
It's an expensive solution, though, isn't it? Isn't that stuff pretty pricey? So that if you,
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. This is, if anybody does, I mean, I just know it exists
because
you have to run. If you're going to run your 57 Chevy, you need to buy whatever this stuff is to put in to run the car.
Yeah, because it requires the octane.
I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe one of our listeners knows the answer to this. But, of course, it's a difference when you're putting 12 gallons in an old Chevy and 150 gallons in a high performance twin times whatever the additive is. I've actually never heard anybody, and I guess what I'm proving is that I'm not keeping up on this the way that I should, but I've never heard anybody talk about additives to make this work. Have you, Max?
No, I think that there are some chemicals that have been added, for example, to G100UL. My recollection is they've got a supplier in Europe. It might be Denmark or something like that. That's got some secret ingredient that is not being shared that's part of the formulation.
Hmm. Well, the EPA says that they plan to issue a proposal for public review and comment sometime this year in 2022. Then they'll, this will sound familiar, then they'll evaluate the comments that they receive and then issue a final finding in 2023. That's their plan. So people will have an opportunity to comment. I don't know if it, is this an NPRM or is it just the same process? I'm not sure.
Well, I believe that would be what the EPA does after it debates all the comments it gets. Then it says, okay, we're going to put out a proposed rule and it's going to say this. But again, I think that's a few years off. But again, I think it's going to get it's going to certainly boot some people in the butt that this is really a problem for America. And we've been kind of slow on the uptake on this. How many years since they dumped it in cars? 40 years, did we say, or something? Yeah,
minimum. I think longer.
Yeah.
And think about how long we've been talking about this in general aviation. I'm sure it's been at least 20 years since people have started looking for a replacement fuel for GA. It's great that they finally solved the problem. I think the problem was a heck of a lot harder than anybody anticipated. But at least now there's a path forward so that we can make that transition without leaving many aircraft behind, if any.
Sure. All right, moving on. Collins Aerospace tells us that Boeing has selected them as the next generation lavatory supplier for the 737. I didn't know there was a next generation lav, but there is for the 737.
It just means it's going to be smaller and smaller and smaller.
That's good, David. That's exactly what I discover when I get into laboratories of newer airplanes. It's impossible to move around in them.
Well, this one has some interesting aspects to it. One is that it's modular and customizable. So there are a lot of options that an operator can select. A touchless faucet is standard, but there's other touchless amenities such as the toilet, the waste bin, the soap dispenser, and some others, which I can see that being an attractive feature. I think I'd like to walk into a lav on board and not have to touch anything if that's possible.
So when you say touchless, you mean that people will touch it less or?
Well, come on, Rob, you've been to restaurants and stuff where you stick your hand under the water and it turns on.
Oh, it never turns on for me. I'm always the guy standing there going, does this one not work? I don't get it.
Do I wave here? Do I wave here? And usually about the time you move your hand, then it turns on.
And when I swear at the faucet, then the other guy says, I don't know, it works for me.
We're going to stay away from Rob's incidents with the lavatory, right?
No, but I think we've all had that experience. So
this thing is really going high tech. It also includes, get this, a centralized computing system to optimize, this is a quote, optimize the passenger experience.
Really?
Improve airline operability and help pave the way for the future or for future technology integration. So I'm wondering, what the heck is a centralized computing system doing in a lav? But apparently, it controls all these touchless components, but it can also be used to provide component health monitoring, predictive maintenance, amenity management, modularity, all these different features. So, you know, computers, everything has become a computer. Cars are computers now. They're not really automobiles. They're computers. Cameras are computers that happen to have a peripheral we call the lens. Everything is a computer. And now the labs are being...
Well, you know what? I think the hackers of the universe are finally excited. They'll be able to hack into a 737 with the next generation laboratory because it's going to be the Internet of Things, the IoT, LAV. So it's the IoT LAV, and it's going to be hacked, and that's how they're going to get control of the airplane.
Well, and I think there's probably going to become a day when they announce that the lavatory is closed. We're having to reboot it. We'll let you know when it's available.
Please stand by while we reboot the lab.
Well, the question is, will it prevent the blue ice incidents that we talk about at least once a year?
See, I'd feel better if they said the next generation lab was going to talk to you. And you know, as you're sitting there, it would go, my, Max, we've got a little problem tonight, don't we?
Well, they didn't call it the 737 Max Lab, I guess, which is probably a good
thing. Thank goodness.
These are supposed to be available on new aircraft, new 737s, beginning in 2025. So we're a few years off from that. But
there's plenty of time for them to screw up the plumbing.
But here's the – well, I think touchless is kind of important. But the other big part of this that I think is important is that they – Collins says that these will be accessible lavatories for passengers of all mobilities. And that's been an issue in the past with people, you know, who have
Absolutely.
Some – yeah. Lavatories have not been, you know, particularly friendly to people with disabilities. And this has been a really big issue that's come up in a lot of different ways.
Well, neither have the airplanes themselves. I mean, you can't get a standard wheelchair down an aisle. They always have to have those special ones that they're very narrow, and they put somebody in it, and then they pull them up the stairs or, you know, down the ramp or whatever because they don't fit.
And then there's lots of reports of people in that situation going to baggage claim to retrieve their wheelchair to find that it's all smashed up or, you know, broken. Another onboard thing besides accessibility has been this issue of holding infants in passengers' laps. This is something that we've talked about in the past.
This one gets Rob's goat.
It really does. It always has.
Yeah, and rightfully so.
It always has.
It makes no sense whatsoever to have a kid in your lap if you have an accident. It's just, you know, from a safety standpoint, it's an awful idea.
Yeah, turn your child into a projectile. Exactly. There's no way you can hold it. That's why you can't hold a baby in an automobile either. Similar reason. It's something that the NTSB has for years called for some action, and nothing is really happening. But now we are seeing Avelo is doing something about it. They've petitioned the FAA for permission to use what's called a baby bear flight vest to restrain infants in flight. So it's baby, you know how to spell that, B-A-B-Y. But then it's B-AIR. So it's either bear or it's just bear. I think it's bear, baby bear, the baby bear flight vest. That would make sense.
I think that's the pun, yeah.
Yeah. So Avelo, they initially had a no-lap child standard. You could not hold your...
No-lap child.
No-lap child standard, right. But they had to reverse that because apparently a lot of customers or some number of customers expressed their frustration to the airline. So they changed policy to allow infants to be held by a parent during flight. But now the airline is looking at these devices, which I guess the baby is held in your chest area by this thing, and you feed the lap belt or the seat belt through this to secure it to you, I guess. But these things are only permitted during cruise. You're not allowed to use these during taxi, takeoff, and landing phases. It's an FAA requirement, which, of course, is maybe perhaps the most critical time to be using these. So there's some rule changes that need to take place here.
Boy, I'll tell you, this is something that goes back a long ways. And I thought when I first started reading this baby bear, I went, that kind of makes some sense. I like that. And then when I saw that no one can use it during takeoff and landing when we really need it, I thought, okay, FAA is involved in this. And that's just one of those dumb and dumber kind of decisions because, it's like the debate we're having about some medical issues these days. People don't realize what can happen in an emergency. Forget an accident. I mean, have you ever been on board an airliner when they do a rejected takeoff? I mean, and you're rolling along and all of a sudden and those brakes go to max braking automatically. And man, everything that's not tied down will come forward. It's another one of those things that I know flight attendants hate it as well. That just they cringe whenever they see somebody holding a child on their lap, especially the ones that are up against the bulkheads where there's they've got the baby's going to fly and it's going to whack the wall and it ain't good. So. And in all these years, I can remember, I probably told this story, 30 years ago when we took Abigail on her first airline flight, we brought a car seat on an American flight. And the flight attendant said, you can't bring that on the flight. You can't use it. And I said, why not? And they said, well, FAA doesn't allow it. And I said, wait a minute. I checked this. There's no law against this. And we got into a heated debate, and one of the pilots came back, and I said, come on, man, I'm one of you guys, give me a break. This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And they went, just let him buckle the damn chair in the, in the seat. Yeah. And they let me do it. And, but again, I would never, we always bought her a seat, just for that reason. But people always think they're saving money by saving on that extra ticket. But man, if you lose the kid in an accident, you didn't save a damn thing.
Hey, I just want to follow up on your comment about a rejected takeoff. I don't recall having been on an airplane that did that, but I watched one up close at El Paso Airport. I was waiting to take off in a Cirrus perhaps a year ago, and they've got intersecting runways there. And they'd cleared the Southwest jet for a takeoff just a few feet from me. And almost immediately after that, they canceled it because they had fighter jets that were landing on the intersecting runway. And that Southwest jet had probably not moved 50 feet before he boarded the takeoff. And then they cleared him for takeoff again. And they said, nope, sorry, our rules require us to go back to the very beginning of the runway again. And I thought, wow, that's a great rule. I mean, yeah, they'd only lost 50 feet, but you don't get in the situation of ever having to guess, is it enough or not enough? So anyway, good on Southwest. I thought that was just a great rule.
Yeah, that is an interesting point.
So I took a look at the Baby Bear website because I was wondering how much these things cost. Are they inexpensive or ridiculous? And they have two models, it seems, the Infant Flight Vest and the Toddler Flight Vest. Both of them are the same price, actually, and they're under $50, a little bit under $50. The Baby Bear website also has some links to some other information about the FAA regulations, but I got a 404 error. I got a page not found with that. So I wrote to Baby Bear a few days ago telling them that they have this broken link, but I haven't heard back from them. But it'd be nice to see what other information they have about these FAA regulations.
And the flight attendant, Goldilocks, says they're just right.
I was just going to say, and you didn't hear back from Mama Bear or Daddy Bear? Papa Bear?
No one was home.
Boy, we're barely getting by with these jokes.
I know you all, listeners, all think we're making this stuff up, but honestly, we're just poking
We're just reporting the news.
We're just reporting the news. Thank you, David.
Another item in the news, Ryanair. Ryanair has 3 Learjets. Who knew? Rob, what's Ryanair doing with 3 Learjets? They, of course, have a giant 737 fleet, around 450 737s in service. They have a few A320s. I think around 39 of them. They're operated by Lauda Europe, but they're, you know, they're a big 737 fleet plus 3 Learjets.
Well, the Learjets are used basically the same way that the bizjet manufacturers use them. I mean, Dassault has a couple of Falcons that it'll dispatch with parts and mechanics if an aircraft is AOG on the ground, and Bombardier has them, and Gulfstream does, because that's great service. There's nothing worse than being broken down, and it almost never happens where the service centers are located. So you got to get parts and mechanics to these things somehow.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting that they had these in the mix of the fleet. And also the utilization is just amazing. For example, they went through each of the 3 aircraft, and they said that if you looked at a 12-month period, this would be for 2021, one of them made 632 flights, averaging 5 flight hours a day, and the others weren't much further behind that. And then they picked one that flew on December 29th, and they ran through the schedule for that day, which started at 0:46 GMT, so just after midnight, and it ended at 23:07, so again, just before midnight, and there were 6 flights on that day. Now, obviously, it wasn't the same crew that was flying that aircraft, but they were bouncing all over Europe, so from London to Mallorca, Mallorca to Barcelona, Barcelona to London, London to Glasgow, Glasgow to Barcelona, Barcelona to London, and I just thought, for an airline that we classically think of as, you know, being a discount airline, which always keeps costs low, I think they've probably figured out that it's a lot less expensive to fly engineers and parts around than it is to have maintenance bases all over the place in Europe.
That's why the costs are low.
We're always kind of dissing Ryanair, but, you know, I mean, this is kind of amazing that they can do this remote operations, you know, deploying these Learjets to carry parts or personnel or whatever. It is kind of an amazing cost-saving feature that, you know, considering all the years we've talked about stand-up seats and charging to go to the lavatory, but, you know, and Ryanair, I'm sure, can't wait to get their hands on the new ones because they can then proceed to put a coin operating slot on them or use your credit card to open said digital lavatory, but I mean, it is kind of phenomenal. And I was also thinking about, boy, those guys who are getting that much time. I mean, how many pilots do they have to operate those 3 aircraft as much as they do?
A bunch.
Pilots have got to be timing out left and right.
Yeah, there's a bunch.
Yeah, they'd need at least 4 sets of pilots, I would imagine, for each aircraft to keep them running around the clock like that. And of course, it's not a single pilot jet. So, you know, take 4 times 2, that's 8 per jet times 3. You got a minimum of 24 pilots, you know, working that. Probably a few more than that, I would imagine.
Now, I believe that Ryanair leases those Learjets, but I could be wrong on that. But nevertheless, talking about the pilots, I would think this would be a great pilot job. I mean, you know, you never know where you're going to go. You're flying around in a Learjet. You know, you've got this sense of urgency always. It sounds like a kind of an interesting lifestyle.
Can I add a real life story here?
Sure.
Back when I was flying charter back in the old days, this was in the past century.
When you had to hand prop the aircraft, huh, Rob?
Yeah. Well, no, Orville did it, and then I did it, and we that's how we got him going. But we got called out in the middle of the night to grab a jet to fly down to O'Hare and pick up a mechanic and actually 2 mechanics and a bunch of tools. And we weren't going that far, maybe just Des Moines, I think, or something like that. But and the airplane had been stuck on the ground at Des Moines for about 4 hours already, and United wanted that thing out of there. They wanted it flying. And so we took the guys to Des Moines and then just, you know, hung out. We waited till they were done, and they said, okay, bring the airplane home. And then we got back in the airplane. And so, again, if you're doing these completely unplanned missions all the time, it could play a little havoc with your system, because you know, some people got lucky and did all the day trips, and junior men got the middle of the night trips. That was the end, actually.
Yeah, I know. I knew it was the end, and I couldn't think of a transition. Our next story comes from Simple Flying. What caused the FAA to issue a brief ground stop on Monday? And this applied, I guess, Mac, to the West Coast primarily.
It did. I got alerted to this almost immediately after it happened by a controller friend of mine who said, hey, you're probably going to start reading about this in the news soon. And he told us that they had been ordered to basically stop everybody at the airport where he worked here on the West Coast. And they essentially told people who were in the traffic pattern, hey, you got to come down now. And people who were taxiing out, they said, nope, hey, sorry, you got to go back. We're not going to put you up in the air. And he said that they were told that it had to do with a missile being fired by North Korea. And then the news story started coming out a few hours later, mentioning that indeed the FAA had issued a ground stop. Now, it was described to me as a nationwide ground stop, so I was kind of surprised to later read that it was really just the West Coast. And there's been speculation in the news that it had something to do with the test flight of a missile out of North Korea, which I'd have to agree with, because that's, you know, what I heard from the controller. So that's what he was being told. And so it kind of raises all kinds of questions. I mean, this was kind of noteworthy in that it was really the first time we've had a ground stop like this since 9/11. This is pretty unusual when the FAA says bring them down, even if they just brought them down for a region of the country. The flight strips, which show up in this article on simpleflying.com, are really kind of interesting. The first strip says ground stop, all departures now. There's another one. I don't know if these are in the right order. It says ground stop, resume normal operations. Sorry for the scare. There's another one that says stop all departures again. No, this is not a joke. More info to follow. And then the last one that says the ground stop has been canceled. You know, I guess you could kind of wonder what good is it going to do if indeed missiles are flying from, you know, North Korea to the U.S. They're probably not going to be able to hit an aircraft that's, you know, in the air. Arguably, arguably the planes might be safer on the ground than they are in the air.
I think I would like to reverse that. I think the aircraft are safer in the air than they are on the ground. There's the reason why we had B-52s orbiting over the poles during the Cold War. It was better to have them on in the air than it was to have them on the ground.
Sure. And I guess I was thinking about this, and I thought, you know, we always, when we study statistics and things, we've got, you know, type one errors and type two errors, and, you know, false negatives, false positives are a great example of that. And I kind of thought about it. I thought, you know what? I don't care if the government kind of leans on the side of, you know, being a little bit too cautious and, you know, things like this. If you go back to 9/11, gosh, there were some data that something might occur, and you could argue that, hey, they weren't, you know, cautious enough. So anyway, it's kind of interesting that this triggered that. You know, my only fear is that it may embolden North Korea to go, hey, look what we were able to do. You know, we were able to rattle our saber and actually have an impact. So anyway, a really interesting story.
To the gentleman pilots, did this affect Hawaii? Was that ground stop also involved with Hawaii, because they're the ones that had the terrorist? I mean, so that was also,
yes.
Okay. Cause I didn't see anywhere that it said, I saw West Coast, but I didn't see anywhere it said Hawaii. And I would think that that would be the number one place they would put.
Sure.
Yeah. There was
it was noted that the ATC recordings for Honolulu suggested that similar instructions were given at that airport. So yeah, it does seem like that was given.
I think the FAA was pretty cryptic throughout this. You know, I don't know what the ATC guy or where the ATC guy got that information, but in terms of what the FAA was saying publicly, I don't think they ever really said that there was an association.
Well, and the other interesting aspect that I read about this or heard was NORAD said, well, we didn't tell the FAA to do the ground stop. You know, you would think that the directorate would come from the North American Aerospace Command to the FAA, but they didn't have any indication that they – so the FAA pulled this trigger on their own. There wasn't any Department of Defense involvement.
And what intelligence did the FAA have? What was their source of information that led them to this? I don't know.
Well, I know that a lot of the agencies have a network where they constantly monitor. And I'm not just talking about the FAA. I'm talking about multiple government agencies. And I know the FAA does participate in this network where they can share in real time, you know, potential, you know, threats to the nation. So, you know, my guess is that the FAA was dialed in on this particular call and they may have taken it upon their own to act. And that's certainly their prerogative. And I support that.
Yeah. Well, you know, we see that FedEx is also trying to protect themselves from I'm not sure what adversaries. You know, it's been a few weeks since we've had a paddleyourowncanoe.com article. So I've been, you know, I've been disappointed that you guys have kind of, you know, fallen off the sled a little bit here. But here we have one this week. FedEx Express seeking permission to install missile downing lasers to some of its aircraft. Sounds
crazy.
Isn't
that a wild story? Yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that. But, you know, it's kind of funny when you think about it. I mean, I think, was it Iran shot down an airliner just in the last year that belonged to, one of the former Russian countries, and certainly
Ukraine.
It was a Ukrainian jet that got shot down by Iran. And, of course, the U.S. Navy a number of years ago shot down an Iranian aircraft that they mistook to be a threat. So these things have happened a couple of times in very modern, you know, times. And I guess FedEx has decided that from a risk management standpoint, it just may be a lot more cost effective to, you know, fit a few airplanes that are in harm's way with missile defense systems rather than have to go afterwards, gee, I guess we really should have done something about it. So again, I think kudos to FedEx for taking the lead on this. The story does mention something which I'm guessing most people know, which is that for many years, El Al has fitted their commercial aircraft that, you know, fly in and out of Israel, fly passengers with missile defense systems. Now, the article notes that they're the older type, which kicks out flares to try and throw off the missiles, whereas this system that's being proposed is something that would use lasers to, you know, confuse the missiles. I hate that this is the world that we live in, but I'm glad that there are people out there who are thinking about these threats and addressing them intelligently. And to me, this is not an unreasonable thing for FedEx
mentioned intelligently, Max, and that, of course, that ends when the FAA gets involved because today.
Are we picking on the FAA? Come on.
Well, I'm sorry, but late today they decided that maybe they shouldn't have published that statement in the first place, and that this is such a special case that they're not going to say they will not do it, but the entire process is going to have to go through an FAA intense evaluation before they decide whether this will actually occur or not. Which, as the I forgot the story that somebody who passed it to me said, that means that the paperwork will be lost in the paperwork, lost in the paperwork, lost in the paperwork. And so if they're going to get them, they're not going to get them anytime soon.
Well, the question is, does FedEx charter aircraft in other, you know, the simplest way to do this is you become like a cruise ship. And if you've noticed any cruise ships that sail in the United States, 90% of them are commissioned in Panama or other countries because so they don't have to follow the rules of the United States. I don't see FedEx having any problem chartering their aircraft overseas if this is something they want.
Smart idea.
I think FedEx owns quite a bit of their fleet, but I might be wrong on that. So Maybe again, maybe a listener will tell us. But again, an American major carrier, I don't think they're going to pull what – who was it that tried to pull – oh, Norwegian tried to pull that on the U.S. A couple of years ago. And they licensed all of their airplanes in Ireland so that they wouldn't have to put up with the Norwegian government or the Americans or anybody else. And, of course, we know what happened to Norwegian. But
well, okay, then how is LAL allowed to fly their aircraft into the United States?
Oh, I didn't say the U.S. wouldn't allow it. I just said they're not going to sanction it for a U.S. carrier right now without a lot more study. That's what they said.
And I thought it was interesting. I hadn't heard this before, but apparently the decision by El Al to fit their missile defense systems came after a 2002 attack on a Boeing 757 operated by another Israeli airline, Arkia, A-R-K-I-A, as it took off from Mombasa in Kenya. Two shoulder-fired missiles were sent their way, but luckily they missed. So, you know, there we've got four examples. So two missiles were fired. Anyway, you count that, and, you know, there's just a lot of this stuff going on, more than you would think.
And one of the reasons why El Al does it is Tel Aviv International, their final approach is on the outskirts of territory where a man pad could be in another country and you could still take out something in the final approach of Tel Aviv, which was, I mean, I think that was also one of the stronger reasons to do it, is because if you're flying into the airport, you're flying over hostile territory. It's no different than a military aircraft popping flares or decoys when they're flying into a military installation. And even the VC-25s have packages, as well as the Marine One aircraft, the VH-60Ns and the VH-3s. They all have flare systems for precisely man-carried shoulder-launched missiles.
Well, when it comes to these infrared laser systems, you know, and the tracking and targeting system that would, you know, go along with it, are these things commercially available? Can you go buy these off the shelf, or is this something that would have to be invented, or something that would have to be some military hardware and software?
It's available hardware. FedEx probably would be able to get it. I mean, you're not going to be able to get it and install it on your Cessna 172, but for all intents and purposes, it's like a laser pointer. It basically spreads a laser beam in the immediate area of the heat-seeking missile, because most of these man pads are heat-seeking, and it blinds the missile and causes it to go off. Laser disruptors have been around for a while, but the technology's there. How FedEx is going to acquire it, I don't know. But I mean, it's a military technology that can be converted over to civilian use.
And we should point out that there's one huge drawback to using this technology. I'm not sure if they're, you know, thinking about that, but, you know, whenever it's deployed, I mean, literally thousands of cats down on the ground go crazy.
Oh no.
I'm sorry. I couldn't keep a straight face.
Okay. Folks, only here could you hear that kind of analysis, that kind of commentary where people take diverse opinions and bring them to you in a state that you can say, wow, those guys are amazing.
You know, pause to you. I mean, or
oh. All right, let's move on. Let's move on.
Now, folks, if you were watching this, you'd see Max Flight grabbing his head like he's got a headache going, oh, my God, I have to edit this.
Oh, passengers behaving badly. We're talking about this all the time, maybe too much. But
I thought we were going to skip this.
Well,
yeah, we're talking about it all the time and too much.
And too much. Just one item of note is that in 2021, the FAA recorded 5,981 reports of unruly passengers, which is just mind-boggling. Also, almost 72% of those were mask-related incidents. We'll have some links in the show notes for some of these. There were some issues with a passenger storming the cockpit in Honduras. And then we also had, and this has been in the news, at JFK Airport, apparently three women are accused of assaulting a security officer at Delta Airlines, knocked him down, beat him with his own radio or something like that. So really, really bad behavior. So if you want to, some examples of what not to get caught up in, we'll have a couple of those in the show notes.
And we were looking for a title. How about co-host behaving badly?
Yeah. Especially if we include the pre-show.
Well, silly co-hosts.
And I can say that none of us have had any alcohol before this, but you can't say that about the 5,000 passengers that got into incidents on airliners. You know, we talked about 80% of those being mask-related. I bet at least 80% of them were alcohol-related as well.
No doubt.
Hey, I hate to bring up our new favorite subject, 5G, but I did see a couple tweets that came out a few hours ago that I figured we might as well just talk about. Apparently, the White House gave an update and thanked AT&T and Verizon for delaying the 5G rollout that was supposed to occur this week. They say the agreement will potentially avoid devastating disruptions to passenger travel, cargo operations, and our economic recovery. And Delta Airlines came out a few minutes ago and warned there could still be flight cancellations due to the 5G rollout, even after AT&T and Verizon delayed it. Some flight restrictions may remain. So, you know, this is still a very big and very active story.
I wonder how some flight restrictions may remain. I'm not. And did AT&T and Verizon agree to delay the whole implementation, or wasn't this just around certain airports?
It doesn't say. It's just a short tweet. But they were supposed to be able to roll out on Wednesday the 19th. And so here a day before, apparently it's been postponed. I think that I read that there was an agreement to run lower power within 2 miles of these affected airports. But again, I'm not sure. I've just seen so many stories, and it's just constantly changing. It's pretty hard to stay on top of exactly, you know, what the status is.
Yeah. And it strikes me as an issue that, I mean, this is thing spun out of control. I mean, it doesn't seem like we ever should have got to this point. And whether it's because of the perspectives, the different perspectives of the FCC and the FAA, or some other reasons, I don't know. But it never should have gotten to this point, in my opinion. And I'm not sure what broke down to allow this to happen.
Well, I think you got two big economic forces that are at odds with each other. You know, you've got the telecom companies that want to move into this new frequency spectrum that they paid $80 billion to use, and rightfully, you know, feel like they're getting cheated if they're not allowed to use it. And you've got the airlines with, you know, some of the equipment up there that's 30 plus years old that kind of feel like, hey, we've never had to worry about these things in the past. Why should we have to spend a few extra dollars to upgrade our equipment when there was no problem in the past? And so, yeah, I think they've just been at loggerheads. They've probably been waiting to see who was going to blink first and, you know, who was going to end up having to shell out a little bit more money than they wanted to. I'm sure this will get sorted out. I did read that there are some radar altimeters that have been cleared and have been approved. And so apparently they have better filtering than some of the older ones. And so they can, you know, do a better job of off-channel frequency rejection. So in other words, they won't be affected by nearby signals like the 5G C-band signals. And it sounds like there's some others that have been identified that will have to be modified or replaced. So, yeah, I think they're working through the process. But, yeah, it's a little messy right now.
Our friend Brian Coleman spoke with our main man, Micah, about an experience that Brian had with United Airlines. It's really a story about purchasing a service that the airline couldn't deliver, and what rights does the customer have to be compensated for the service that they didn't get. So we'll listen to Brian and Micah.
Hello, it's your main man, Micah, and I'm here with you again with
Brian Coleman, I think I'm going to refer to myself now as the field correspondent.
I like that because you've always been outstanding in your field.
Yep, that I have.
So we're back to kind of talk about a resolution to an issue that that came up quite some time ago after you you booked a flight that didn't quite go so well to Frankfurt. Why don't we go back and kind of fill people in? Brian, you know, when you book a flight, and I know because you booked flights for me, you look at every last detail and you make your choices using your points or your cash for the best possible product. When you were booking your flight to Frankfurt, what were you choosing to get you there? What kind of service were you looking at and what did you book?
Yes, I've been told that I'm fairly anal when it comes to booking plane tickets. And on this particular flight, I wanted to get really the best experience possible. So I looked for an aircraft that was going across the pond where I could sit in Premium Plus. That's the improved economy cabin on United, for those that might not be familiar. One step below business class, but certainly a step above regular economy. So I found a flight out of San Francisco that went over to Frankfurt that had the Premium Plus cabin.
Now, let me just ask you so I got this straight, because when we talk about classes of flight, basically we think about economy, premium economy, business, and then first class. Where does the Premium Plus fit in if you're going like that? Is it a different level of service?
It's United's name for premium economy. Other airlines call it premium economy. I think because United has the Economy Plus section, they wanted a different name, so they referred to it as Premium Plus.
Okay, so what is the difference between Economy, Economy Plus, and Premium Plus on United?
With United Economy, you have the smallest seat pitch possible. In Economy Plus, you have, and I love their marketing on this, they say up to 5 inches of extra legroom, because sometimes it could be just 2 or 3 inches, but there are certain seats where there are 5 inches of legroom, so that's kind of nice. The Premium Plus product is a separate cabin. Typically, there are 3 rows in a 2-4-2 configuration. And then, of course, there's business class.
Okay, so Premium Plus is definitely a separate cabin, not just a seat in an exit row, which is what they might call Economy Plus.
Exactly.
Great. So you booked the Premium Plus. You started off in LA, but that was Premium Plus from San Francisco to Frankfurt.
Correct.
And then you were flying in Germany. You were flying on Lufthansa. You also had to book some seats on Lufthansa. And United told you they couldn't do that for you when you were trying to book it online?
Which is fairly common in that if you're booking an economy ticket or even a Premium Plus ticket for the connecting flight, and I was connecting from Frankfurt to Hamburg, you cannot book your Lufthansa seats until 24 hours in advance. It's only if you book in business class can you book your business class seats on Lufthansa? So that was normal, but I ran into an issue at the airport on day of travel trying to book my Lufthansa seats.
Okay, so let's talk about what happened. Here you are flying from LA to Frankfurt via San Francisco. That stop in San Francisco is when you book your seats on Lufthansa, and you're flying from San Francisco to Frankfurt in Premium Plus. What happened?
That's almost correct. I tried to actually book my Lufthansa seats when I was in Los Angeles, but I was told that they actually never gave me a good reason as to why I could not book my seats on Lufthansa. But they said that it wouldn't be an issue for me to book my seats once I got to San Francisco. And unfortunately, there was a bit of delay leaving Los Angeles because they were working on the runway in San Francisco. So they imposed what's known as flow control, where they delay flights taking off to land in San Francisco so they don't get backed up and you have to drill holes in the sky around San Francisco. So we waited on the ground in Los Angeles for a while. When I got to San Francisco, I really had to run from Terminal 3 over to the International Terminal, and I was not able to stop into the United Club in order to take care of the seat assignment.
That's not the worst of the situation, not being able to book on Lufthansa. That's part of what happened. But what changed when you got to San Francisco that made this into first world disaster?
What happened when I was in San Francisco is they said, oh, just go to the club in the International Terminal, except the club at the International Terminal was closed. So even if there was time for me to go over there, it wasn't possible to go because they were closed and there certainly wasn't enough time to go back to Terminal 3 to deal with the seat issue there.
I basically went from my United States domestic flight to boarding the plane. There wasn't time to do anything else. That might not be the issue that you're alluding to here.
Well, I guess I wanted to ask you, what was it like? And, you know, this was your first time in United's Premium Plus. How was it?
Well, I didn't actually get to fly in Premium Plus because this goes back to a problem that I tried to resolve before I got on the plane. When I booked my ticket, I, of course, booked an aircraft that had Premium Plus, except United canceled that flight due to COVID, I understand. They have two flights a day going from San Francisco to Frankfurt. The afternoon flight has a Premium Plus cabin. The morning flight does not. They canceled the afternoon flight. So therefore, they accommodated me on the morning flight from San Francisco to Frankfurt, except that aircraft does not have the Premium Plus cabin.
Now, wait a minute. You paid for Premium Plus. They changed planes, so there's no Premium Plus available. So they must have put you into business class.
No, they didn't do that either. They said, have a nice day. A frustrating part of this whole story is I tried to get the ticket resolved, the pricing of the ticket, because I was really looking for a refund of the difference in price between an economy ticket versus the Premium Plus ticket, because the aircraft that I was on didn't have a Premium Plus cabin. Therefore, why should I pay for a product that simply doesn't exist? And United said, no, they weren't going to refund me the difference. And the difference was about $500. And to go back a little bit, part of the reason why I booked in Premium Plus is I was hoping to get an upgrade to business class. And the chances of getting upgraded from Premium Plus to business is much greater than if you're going from economy to business class, because you're paying more for the ticket. And that makes sense. You're just closer in a fare basis to the business class ticket. So if space is available, they're going to choose the people that have paid more for their ticket.
So let me get this straight. Okay. I just want to make sure I have this right. This is confusing. You paid for a special seat in a Premium Plus cabin. That seat wasn't available. You gave the company, United Airlines, you gave them extra money for it, and they didn't have the seat. And they wouldn't give you your money back either? So you didn't get, they kept your money and downgraded you?
Not only that, they said that they would not deal with this as a pricing or a ticket issue until I completed my travel. So I knew about the change of aircraft a month or so before I departed. And they said, you can't do anything. There's no form to fill out. There's nothing you could do until you complete your travel. Then you could write into us and we'll take a look and evaluate your circumstances and make a determination as to what to do about it.
Hang on. I just want to make sure I have this right. They knew ahead of time they couldn't give you the seat that you paid for. They were aware of it, that they cut the seat out. It wasn't there. They were aware that you paid extra for it. And they said, we're not going to give you the seat. We're not going to give you your money back. Just fly it as it is and then talk to us about it. And we'll think about whether or not you're deserving of a refund.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And that's what I ended up doing. I ended up flying on the flight, wrote to them when I returned home, and received a really nice letter back from them saying, no, you're not entitled to any money, which of course didn't sit very well with me. Since the first letter didn't work, I called them up and talked to the folks in refunds, and they said, well, you can't do it over the phone. You have to do it through the web form, submit a web form. So I submitted a web form, waited another 2-3 weeks, got rejected again. Appealed that, called them back. They said, oh, this isn't a revenue refunds issue. This is a customer service issue. You have to talk to the people in customer service. So I talked to the people in customer service and they say, no, this isn't a customer service issue. This is a refunds issue. So back and forth since August, I have been writing to them or calling them on the phone to try and get this resolved and let them know that they put me on an aircraft that didn't have the cabin that I had paid for.
Which they knew before you flew.
Yep, that they did.
Something just doesn't sound very right here. Now, you are very persistent among these kinds of things because you, like me, are a cheapskate and you're not going to spend $500 for nothing. So you've gotten rejected now, based on, if I counted up right, at least four times, because they're moving you from one department to another, not caring that they have your money and that they owe you that, and not caring that you're a frequent flyer with thousands and thousands of points and millions of miles with them.
Yep. Oh, they cared. They said that they valued my business very much. And to let you know how persistent I was, there were 17 communications with me making my appeal and them declining me.
This does not look very good for United. I mean, and I don't think, well, I think actually this is the scary part. This isn't unique for United. United is typically okay when it comes to customer service by comparison to others who will go nameless like American. But this is 17 communications. Most people would have just given up. And I guess that must have been what they were hoping for, that you would just give up and say, there's nothing I can do. I've lost the money.
Yeah, I really think that that's part of it. In the insurance industry, they have a saying, delay, deny, let them die. And that's their way of resolving issues. So they'll delay a claim as much as possible. They'll deny a claim as much as possible. And they hope the patient dies along the way. Therefore, they don't have to pay the claim. And I really feel as though this is what was happening to me at United. And like you said, since I'm a bit frugal, I would not let this one go. And I wouldn't let them win.
17 different correspondences with United Airlines, with different departments, different people. I'm sure you could never get the same person on the phone or via email or anything.
Exactly.
How did you finally resolve this?
I ended up going for my last-ditch effort in writing a letter to the person who said that they, at this point, they said they were personally going to handle and see the case through completion, because I talked about, like you said, the quantity of people that I had talked to about this. And I said, okay, great. I'm finding someone that's going to take personal responsibility for this. She had written me back saying, well, we've talked about this internally and we've made the determination that you aren't entitled to anything because we got you there. We got you back safely. Everything's fine. So I wrote back one last time to this person and I said, here's where I disagree with you, because you basically have sold me a product that doesn't exist. And that I believe is not right. And if you were to have this situation happen to a loved one, someone that you cared for, how would you resolve this for them? And I think that letter and that tone is what made the difference, because the next communication from this individual was, we really value your business. We understand what happened. Although the fare difference was a little bit more than $500, I think it was like $528, they said, what we can do is offer you a $500 future flight credit. Is that acceptable? To which I said, yes, and granted, I'm out the $28. But the fact that they stepped up and gave me the future flight credit for approximately the difference in fare, I think was a fair and equitable outcome.
It's fair enough, I suppose. But this is an incredible example of customer no service that's not just limited to airlines. And it also turned into a no-win situation for United, because here they are finally doing close to the right thing by refunding you partially what you paid for it, yet you're miserably unhappy with United. And and fortunately, we have a little bit of a voice, so we can let our listeners know what happened, what to expect, and United can't get a good reputation from this because they handled this poorly. There is no ifs, ands, and buts. This was totally incorrect in how they handled it. And really what at that point they should have done is said, here's your $528 in cash, and here's a free round trip ticket to wherever you want to go. We're very sorry.
I don't exactly see things your way. So yes, I'm frustrated with them over how they handled the situation. They could have handled it so much better and resolved it so much faster. But I think that the resolution that we got to was good enough. And I'm not sure if they had a financial limitation on their end that they could only do $500 or what the situation was. I'm actually satisfied with them for eventually agreeing to see things my way. And I doubt that they just conceded because I was so persistent. they sold me a product that existed when they sold it to me, but then they put me on a product that didn't exist.
Yeah.
Right. They were not able to deliver the product that I had paid for. And that's what, to me, the point was. So for our listeners, I think the lesson to be learned here is don't be discouraged when you find someone that doesn't give you the answer that you truly believe that you're entitled to. Is don't give up. Keep pushing. Keep asking for what you're doing. And the entire time, I must say, I never once got defensive. I never once got argumentative with them. I was always incredibly polite with each and every one of my communications with them. And I think that that helped as well, because I've seen so many times at airports where passengers have just gone crazy. They go ballistic over the gate agent who I truly believe in most cases is trying to help them resolve a problem, but the policy prevents them from doing so. And I think here, either I wasn't very good at explaining what the situation was, or their policy was preventing them from solving it. But again, my point is, I didn't give up, and I don't think customers should either.
Yes, and I agree, and that's good advice. But for 17 correspondences and 4 months, they should have compensated you for your time.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the story of Brian's flight to Frankfurt back in August. Finally resolved. United, shame on you. But thank you for finally getting at least something done.
And again, they got me there safely, relatively on time, even though I didn't have time in the airport in San Francisco. And that was really one of my biggest, well, can't say it was one of my biggest frustrations, but that was one of the frustrations with this flight, because I truly booked this where I had plenty of time at every airport, the connections or issues with a return flight as well, some logistical issues in comparison that were minor. But here I thought I had booked just the perfect itinerary where I could leisurely get to my destination, have appropriate time doing everything, and it just didn't turn out that way. So best laid plans.
And we're finding that again, as you know, as we are planning or hoping that we're still going to be able to travel together to the UK in February. But in the meantime, my ticket has changed, what, five times since we booked it, with them cutting out flights. And we still don't know what's going on with it.
And it will probably change another 4 times between now and then. So, yes, you are absolutely correct.
Be patient. Travel is not necessarily easy, although there's no reason why it couldn't be. Nonetheless, we're dealing with interesting customer-owned service corporations. Brian, great talking with you.
Thank you so much, Micah.
So for the Airplane Geeks here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
And your field correspondent, Brian. Fly safely.
My main reaction to this was that Brian is an incredibly persistent guy. And you know, he wasn't going to give up on this. And I would not have the energy to be that persistent. I think I would have tried a couple of times to get some satisfaction from the airline. But I think in the end, which would have been much quicker than was the case with Brian, I would have said, that's it. That airline's dead to me. Fine. If they're going to treat me that way, then I'm not going to give them any more business. And I would have been done with it. Brian, of course, took a different approach and got to a resolution that he was relatively happy with.
Well, he did have some skin in the game, too. I mean, he is trying to eventually get to this 1K status. And if you said, the airline's dead to me, I mean, all that kind of goes out the window. And so I don't think Brian was willing to give that up. But again, you know, most businesses assume that no one's going to work that hard. And the big bureaucracies, the phone companies, the utilities, airlines, again, some of the other big ones, they just go, yeah, I don't know. Well, you know, I'm sorry, you've got the wrong person. You need to talk to that person who tells you, no, it's the other person. You've got it. And they run you around and they just, oh, they're going to hang up anyway. And again, there are some people that don't. And that's how stories like this get started. It would have been nice if the airline in question, which shall go nameless, United, just said, oh, gosh, you know, we screwed up. Okay, we'll fix it. Because they knew they were wrong. I mean, there was no doubt that they were wrong, but they just can't imagine giving in. And then even if they wanted to, they'd say, well, but that's not my decision. You have to talk to the customer relations supervisor that covers that area, and then you try to find them. And it's endless.
Yeah.
Rob, that was fabulous. I think you just in a minute described customer service in our modern age. So, yeah, that's absolutely the case. I think that you know, part of it, and maybe there's a – you know, for really large organizations, I worked in a big one. I know, Max, you worked in a big one. There's also an element of it's impossible to organize so well that everybody knows exactly who to transfer you to. So there's only one transfer of the phone, which is why sometimes you get these multiple hops. And, you know, it's unfortunate that the businesses aren't better organized to make that a single hop. But yeah, that's the reality. The people that get this kind of satisfaction have the time to invest in the patients to talk to, you know, 4, 5, 6 different, you know, people on the phone. Thank goodness my wife is willing to be one of those people because I just don't have the time. I've got too many things that I'm trying to do. I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
So are we going to hear Brett's response?
Yes, we are. As I mentioned before, Brian chased down Brett at an event that we'll talk about another time. And this just came in just really a few minutes before we started recording, so we haven't heard this. Let's see what Brett's perspective was. It's, of course, Brett Snyder, the Cranky Flyer.
I'm here at the Northern Pacific Airways livery launch event with Brett Snyder of Everything Cranky. Brett, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great. Anytime there's a event around the LA area, there we are. So
yeah, quite happy to talk to you as well. And one more segment for the podcast. So what do you think of the launch event so far? You were able to have some quality time with the CEO?
Did have some quality time there. We'll see. I mean, it's actually quite an event. There are a lot of people here. They were telling me over 400 people have RSVP'd. And the livery reveal, I mean, who doesn't want to go look at a pretty airplane?
Exactly.
not necessarily as bullish on the prospects of the entity, but I guess we'll see because we don't know a huge amount yet.
I don't know. I think that it's interesting that they're following the Iceland Air model of using Anchorage as the center point. And if you do the Great Circle route, they are pretty much halfway between Asia and North America. So now it's if they could get all the slots and get people on board, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think the devil's in the differences on this one, which is between Iceland and Alaska. So I'll be interested in that one as well.
You were supposed to be on the show. Well, we were supposed to do the recording of the show last night, do the editing today, launch it to the world tomorrow. But there was an issue where we couldn't do the record. So we're definitely going to have you back on the show. One of the segments that we were going to run was the piece that Micah and I did about the experience that I had on United and getting a refund for a fare difference of a product that they sold me that ended up not existing. Before the resolution, I had contacted you asking for some advice, and I think that's sort of a Cranky Concierge type product or service. Would you agree?
Well, it is and it is not, which is entirely unhelpful.
Okay.
But yeah, so really for us, if we've done the booking, so we have people that come to us where we start with the booking and we go all the way through, even not just flights, we handle, you know, the whole trip. But for the flights, if we've done the booking, then this is something we definitely follow up on because we have access to all the agency tools. So, you know, it's tied to the IATA we book through and we can go to the exec desk at United. We have salespeople that are very responsive and get things escalated to the right place. So we can do that. If we don't book it, though, and people do come to us just to monitor their flights they've already booked, there's not much more that we can do than in a regular situation where you're emailing customer relations 17 times. You know, it's the same type of thing. If there's something really egregious that just seems like a right needs to be wronged or a wrong needs to be righted, we can sometimes try and lean on friends or something like that, but we really don't want to do that. So we try and stay in our lane, you know, as much as we can on those types of things.
Right. So it's really my bad that I didn't book the ticket through Cranky Concierge to begin with.
Well, yeah.
Of course.
No, I mean, at the time when people are booking, it always seems great. Hey, I found this great fare. You jump on it, you do whatever. It's when things go wrong that it starts to be tough. And granted, you book direct. That's not bad. Mm-hmm. at least you didn't book through Expedia or someone like that, where good luck on any customer service there. But, you know, otherwise, yeah, it's the kind of thing that if people have booked through us, they just, if something does go wrong, they don't really have to worry about that. They'll just hoist it upon us to deal with it.
Yeah, and it certainly seems like whenever I'm in a hotel and at the front desk checking in and there's a problem, the booking usually seems to have happened through an Expedia or Priceline or one of those type services. So it's nice knowing that the cranky team is there to take care of your customers when things go wrong.
Yeah, we do our best. We're hamstrung by whatever the airlines and hotels and whatever will allow us to do, but we are pretty persistent as well. Right. Maybe not 17 emails persistent, but still pretty persistent.
Yeah, that's just my personality. One of the things that I do is listen to the Cranky Talk podcast. And the other day, I might be a little bit behind, but I was listening to the show that you did with Dave where he had returned from Europe. And it certainly seems like traveling to Europe these days is a little bit different than it was 3 or 4 years ago. Now, I believe that he went to Europe before the current variant. So what was it, November, December of last year when he went?
He went over Thanksgiving. So when he returned, Omicron was a thing. But he actually came back 2 days before the U.S. changed the rule from 72 hours to 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a little bit stuck in the middle of that and somewhat afraid of getting home. But he made it. It's fine. Everything's fine, Dave.
But my question is really around, Mike and I are planning on going to England in February.
Yeah.
Do you think we're crazy for doing that? Do you think we will have challenges? Should we have booked our tickets through Cranky Concierge to avoid any problems? What are your thoughts towards this?
Yeah, well, of course you should have, but that's a different issue. Will it be challenging? Probably. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, though. That doesn't mean you're crazy at all. I mean, I'd go over there now. I don't have a problem with that. The issue arises when something just pops up out of nowhere, like Omicron. You can argue whether that's out of nowhere, but the UK government reacted so swiftly and stupidly that it was so difficult to figure out exactly what the rules were on any given day. We had people, when this broke at Cranky Concierge, we had people we were working with, and they say, okay, well, there's this day two test you have to do once you arrive. That doesn't actually mean you take it on day two. It just means you take it between when you arrive and day two. And so people are freaking out about this, like, wait, I'm going to have to sit in a hotel room for 2 days on my 4 day trip. Like, that's not going to work.
Right.
But that's not actually what it is. But then also in the UK, it has not been easy to get these tests. They used to have the lateral flow test allowance, which they've now gone back to. But briefly, they said, no, it has to be PCR. And it's exceedingly hard to get that in the UK for some reason. It's not quite as easy as it seems to be, especially a rapid test. Not rapid, but, you know, same day result. And so we had people saying, well, what about this? Might this work? What about this one? It took, you know, a little bit of time to figure out, all right, what's the right course of action here? Now, hopefully, until the next variant, it'll stay pretty steady. So, you know, you don't have to do the pre-departure test anymore. You still have to do the day two test, but they have increasingly better options upon landing at Heathrow that you can sign up for right there.
And you do that before you clear customs or after you clear customs?
That's a good question. I don't know that.
I could cut that,
actually. Yeah. It doesn't matter. That's a good question. I'm not actually 100% sure. I think it's after, because you go, I mean, I guess I don't even know.
We'll report back when we do the trip and do our trip report on it.
Sure, yeah.
And then Micah is coming straight back to America, so he has to do his antigen test within 24 hours before he comes back,
I think? It's a day now. So it's not, okay. They're very clear on that. It's 1 day. It's not 24 hours. So you don't have to go and time it with your departure. So it's 1 day. And it's an antigen test, but you can't just get any antigen test. It has to be proctored by someone. So I know EMED is a really good option. Mm-hmm. It's the Binax test, but you know, someone's watching you do it. They don't trust you enough to let you do it on your own, even though I have to imagine it'd still be pretty easy to fake. I don't know.
I took it when I came back from Germany, and so I had my 15 minutes of being on a video call with the medical professional watching me do it. But I think, yeah, I didn't necessarily have to tickle my brain the way others do when they administer the test.
No, it's...
So it does seem, I don't know, on the one hand, I think that it's kind of silly. On the other hand, I'm glad that people are doing it. I personally wish that everyone who could be vaccinated was vaccinated before they get on an airplane, but that's a whole different conversation. And that's the reason why I created the email of IamReallyOffended@yahoo.com so people can send their fan mail to that address and we could take up a private conversation there. But yeah, just traveling during the times of COVID seem to be a lot more challenging than they used to be with all these tests. And it seems like the test requirements are constantly changing.
Right. That's the issue. And it's not even just that. Flight schedules are changing. So we have...
Yes, we've been through that numerous times.
No question. I mean, we probably spend twice as much time on a client these days before they even go anywhere, just because of significant schedule changes, the efforts that need to be made to get them on something that works, because in the past, usually there's something that's not too horribly different. Now, that's not necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be more challenging. And just trying to help people understand what the rules are, answer their questions. We don't say that we keep up to date by the minute on this. We give people, we partner with Sherpa. So we have crankyconcierge.com/Sherpa. You put in your trip information and it gives you up to the minute exactly what you need. But even with that, people still have questions. And so it is really, I guess, a good time to be in the concierge business. But
yeah, it seems like a full-time job. From when Micah and I first booked the tickets through today, the itineraries probably changed 5 or 6 times.
Sure.
The testing requirements have changed at least 3 that I'm aware of, and we're still a month away.
Yeah.
Or half a month away.
It does change quickly. That is the thing.
Yeah. So this will be interesting. Other than that, what's going on in the cranky world?
Well, I guess the big thing is we have the Cranky Network Awards coming up, which is February 24th.
In my hometown, and I'm going to miss it because I'm going to be in England.
Well, see, that's on you.
Yeah. Bad timing.
Yeah. But yeah, the Cranky Network Awards are February 24th in Pasadena and presented by Ontario International Airport. So that's how we did Pasadena, which is part of their catchment area there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really about recognizing the airline network teams that have done Herculean work here during the pandemic. So pretty excited for that. We're doing it in person as of now, but we will be live streaming it as well. So should be a lot of fun.
And if people can't participate through the live stream, you'll have it on YouTube or some other video platform so people can watch it later?
Yeah, later on. Yeah. So it'll be live stream on YouTube. I believe that's how it's working. We have someone doing this, but you'll be able to watch the archive for sure later on.
Yeah, great. So we'll be able to catch up on that.
Yes. Yes. Unless you want to wake up at 2:30 in the morning.
Who knows? We might be awake anyway.
Yeah, right.
Anything else that our listeners should know about?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I mean, Cranky Flyer, the blog is still going. That's 15 plus years in now. And Cranky Network Weekly is where I've been spending a lot of time on the weekly network changes and putting that together. But still working on some ideas where I know some people miss on the blog the Skeds of Airlines weekly soap opera of network changes. Cranky Network Weekly is a much more expensive product that's meant more for Wall Street analysts type of stuff for airlines. But we're looking at seeing if we can come up with something that might be more affordable for people who miss the fun-filled drama in airline
fill. Yeah, they were always fun to read.
Yeah, try to have fun with it because it generally is so miserable. You're reading all this terrible news. You're like, oh, boy.
Well, if you put some fun and levity into what might be considered, some might consider boring data.
Yeah, well, that's the goal, at least.
So. Yeah, you make it fun to read.
We have fun with it.
Yeah. Hey, well, Brett, thank you so much for being on the show. Yeah. And we look forward to having you as a guest so Max and team can continue and ask all the other questions that I didn't ask today.
Yeah, my pleasure. I mean, I will say wasn't too sad about last night since it meant I could watch the Rams playoff game. But still, you know, I'm ready.
Yep.
Put me in coach.
Or first class.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Brett's been doing this for a long, long time, and between crankyflyer.com and crankyconcierge.com and all the other content that he produces, there's a lot of great knowledge there. Cranky Concierge, we've talked with Brett about in the past, quite a while ago, but they do both domestic and international travel planning. So it's a good resource. These are kind of the experts at travel planning. And so for certain kinds of situations, they can be a really great asset. So you want to thank Brett for taking the time to talk with us.
And he doesn't sound cranky at all. So that's good.
I know. Yeah, he's a really nice guy. All right, what's up with the geeks? David, let's start with you. Goings on at the museum.
I was working on an exhibit of modeling scales. We have lots of models, but one of the things people don't realize is when someone says it's 1/48th or 1/72nd scale, what does it mean? So I've always wanted to do an exhibit on modeling scales since the day before time when I worked at the hobby shop. So I got all of our AH-1 models together and put them out on the stub wing of our AH-1. So you got to see the real one with all the little ones underneath it. But later on in the afternoon, we had our second TFR bust occur. We had one about this time last year where the president of the United States is at his house in Delaware, and we are right on the border of the no-fly zone. And we had a MD-530 decide that it was going to fly over the no-fly zone, and I found out about it because I had an F-15C trying to break all the windows of my hangar. The helicopter landed, the F-15C orbited our airfield, much to the pilot's flight schools. I had four flight school aircraft sitting on the ground at the end of the runway waiting to take off, and they couldn't move for about 30 to 40 minutes. The F-15 lurked until the Coast Guard flew out with an MH-65. It wasn't as quick to arrive as it was the last time. What was interesting, though, is when the helicopter landed, the airport was notified, and suddenly the fuel truck got awfully close to the helicopter, so the helicopter couldn't take off, which was kind of an interesting event. And then the MH-65 showed up, and eventually the police showed up, and eventually, a couple of hours later, this went away. But it definitely is an interesting air show when all of a sudden you have an F-15 come screaming over your airfield at about 1,000 feet. Everybody in the neighborhood knows, and then my phone starts ringing, why are you having an air show in the middle of January? And you have to explain to people, no, it's just the president at the Delaware White House.
Wow.
So if you go to my Instagram, and Max will put the links in the show notes, you can see the F-15 and the MH-65 and the culprit. As all of our pilots know out there, read your TFRs, because you end up ruining a lot of people's days by violating airspace that you're not supposed to.
Yeah, in the battle days, you used to end up in handcuffs and get interviewed by the Secret Service. I don't know what the current process is. I don't think it's quite that bad, but it's not good. And I think it leads to an automatic suspension. I think you're going to lose your license for 60 days or something like that. Again, that I'm not sure of that.
Well, it was interesting that the helicopter did take off. The last time when we had the F-16 intercept, the helicopter was on the ground for at least 24 hours. In this case, this helicopter took off about 3 hours after the event occurred. So I was sort of surprised. But if you look up the tail number and go on to Flight Tracker, it's interesting. You can see it chugging down the coast and doing a quick U-turn to KOQN, which is Brandywine Regional, which is my airport. So it's interesting when the Air Force decides to force an aircraft into our airport. I'm waiting for the next one. We're two for two for helicopters. I'm waiting for the next one to be an airplane.
Wow. Oh, Max Trescott, what have you been looking? What does it say? A new Viagra app?
Yeah.
Oh, I sure hope that's something else.
I sure hope that I spelled that correctly. Hey, just to follow up on TFR, I went and looked on a legal website here. It says, depending on the type of TFR, you can get punished in three different ways. You can be criminally punished up to a maximum of 1 year in federal prison and a $100,000 fine. You can have your pilot license suspended or revoked, or receive a civil penalty by itself on top of the $100,000 fine. So, people, mind your P's and Q's. Do your work. And David, are you at the outer edge, like the 30-mile ring, or are you next to the 10-mile inner core?
Oh no, we're in the 30-mile. Okay. I'm 18 miles away from the house.
Got it. Yeah. And I think that's where it's a lot easier to get these violations, is when you're so far away that you wouldn't even think that, hey, we couldn't possibly be, you know, close to the place. I know a friend of mine had a mechanic fly into Byron, California, which doesn't even feel like it's the San Francisco Bay Area. It's so far away. And it was just about a mile or so inside that 30-mile ring. And so, yeah, it's easy to get caught up in that. Well, let's see. That doesn't say Viagra. It says Virga. So, that's okay. No, I thought maybe I mistyped it. In episode 216 of Aviation News Talk, among other things, we talked with the developer of the Virga app. And I'm excited about this. I've known about it for a year, but it was missing one key function, which it now has. And it allows pilots to easily generate a PIREP, that is a pilot report, an observation of what they see in flight, about what the weather conditions look like. Previously, the Virga app users could share PIREPs with each other. So you would be sharing it with, you know, folks in your club, or, you know, it's an easy way to kind of communicate with other users. But now, when you enter a PIREP, it actually goes into the national system and everybody anywhere can see it. It's also got a really cool alerting type function where you can draw a ring around a particular area. So I've drawn a nice big, you know, circle on the app around the greater San Francisco Bay Area, and I've put in some altitudes. And when I go to it, now it shows me every PIREP within that circle, within that altitude range. So I don't care about PIREPs at, you know, flight level 350 and so on. I'm more concerned about ones that are down lower. So I'm very excited about this, because the big problem with PIREPs is pilots don't generate enough of them. There are so few and far between that there are just huge gaps in our knowledge about the weather, because, you know, pilots don't do that. And the traditional way of doing it is kind of a pain. You end up having to, you know, leave the frequency you're talking to. You call a flight service station. You give them the information. That will get into the system. You could give it to the controller, but that's very iffy as to whether they'll actually pass that along. That's very spotty, because I don't think they view it as their primary responsibility. But here you can whip out your phone. You can go ahead and enter the app and not really need to memorize all the format, because it takes care of that for you. And then if you happen to have cellular data in the air, it will transmit it at that point. If you don't, when you get a cell connection, either later on in the flight or after you get it back on the ground, it will transfer the PIREP over to the system. So I'm excited about this. It's the first thing I've seen.
You're encouraging people to use 5G in an airplane flying over an airport. What's wrong with you, Mr. Trescott?
I'm encouraging people to make more PIREPs, because it helps make pilots safer. And so to find it, go into it. By the way, it's only iPhone right now, but they are working on an Android app. And you want to go in and search for Fly Virga, two separate words, in the App Store. And I'd encourage folks to try it out. Oh, did I mention the best part of the app? The price.
Yeah,
it's free.
Wow.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, there are no in-purchase subscriptions. There's no nothing. A year ago when they brought it out, there was a fee for it, but at some point they decided, nah, let's just make this free. So it's the favorite price of aviators. So anyway, check out episode 216 Aviation News Talk, and we talk about it there.
Great. Rob, anything from you, or can we move on?
Just one question, actually, related back to what David was showing us. David, in that picture that we can people will be able to see in the show notes, can you explain to us what scales the various aircraft are on the wing here?
This is actually on the stub wing of our AH-1F. So all of these are AH-1s, and working from left to right in the picture, it is 1/24th, 1/32nd, 1/48, and 1/72nd.
And those are all Cobras, right?
They're all the same helicopter on top of the helicopter.
Some listener feedback. We heard from James. He says, I was listening to your latest episode, which was 686, when Max Trescott was talking about his new GoPro Max camera. I have one of these too and love playing with it. I set up a YouTube channel and have been having a blast playing with the camera, editing and posting 360 videos and more traditional format videos. So he's flying a 1971 Piper Cherokee 6. It's got dual Garmin G5s, Garmin 430, and GFC 500 autopilot. And he notes that he's a part owner with a couple of other guys, and they're based out of Eastern Virginia. So he's using this GoPro Max mount on the outside. So, too many Maxes here. So, Max, how does this camera do 360s?
Oh, it's really fascinating. Some people have kind of asked, hey, does the camera have something in it that rotates, or do you control a rotation? And the answer is it's got two lenses, one on the front, one on the back, and it captures all of the directions simultaneously. So you can think of any particular frame as looking like a huge circle, kind of like a globe. And then, of course, that's not very helpful because we can't really see the world 360 degrees around us. And so if you use the app, which GoPro supplies, the GoPro Quick app, you can go into the footage that you've shot, and then you can, either point the camera in all your iPhone in all directions and kind of look at the video that you shot, or you can use your fingers to drag it and look in any direction. And then once you've figured out an orientation that you want to use to put into a normal video, you basically specify the start frame and the end frame and the orientation that the camera is pointing at the beginning frame and the end frame. So for example, if I wanted to do a 360 degree rotation, I'd pick a start frame with it pointed forward. And then come to think of it, I'm not sure if 360 is going to work, but let's just say it's 180. That's really simple. You pick an end frame that's 180 degrees, and it will look like the camera smoothly rotated, from the forward position to the rear position. And it's actually kind of eerie just how smooth it is, but it's all done in software, and it's just picking out the particular view for each of the different frames. So you can't really look at it all simultaneously, unless you just, kind of use your phone and move your phone and then you can see it. But you could never really play back the video that way.
I had a chance to play with a Garmin. Garmin brought out a similar technology, maybe 4 years ago. They sent me one at the magazine to evaluate, and it was really neat. And I downloaded the video and I looked at it and I said, looks like standard video. I mean, what's special about that? And the lady, Jessica Koss, I don't think we ever had her on the show, but she used to be the PR person at Garmin. And she said, did you download the Garmin software for editing? I said, you never told me that. Oh, didn't I tell you that? Oh, yeah, because you got – well, then, as Max said, it is pretty cool when you see it.
Neat stuff. All right. Well, as we mentioned, I think last episode, if you've got a YouTube channel or other videos, aviation videos, particularly videos that you've produced from your aircraft or attached to your aircraft, send them along to us and we'll give you a plug. And we'll have a link in the show notes to James' YouTube channel. We heard from a different James, follow up on the EU slot ghost flight discussion. He says an important point was missed. Competitors, particularly the LCCs like Ryanair, EasyJet, and Wizz, strongly oppose any slot usage relief that allows folks like Lufthansa off the hook. These LCCs argue that if the legacy carriers don't want to utilize their large and valuable slot holdings, they should be returned and other carriers be given the rights instead. The LCCs view these ongoing waivers as nothing more than an economic cover for these legacies, allowing them to squat on their slots, while the LCCs are blocked from offering their own services, and that ultimately hampers competition. And he provided a couple of recent stories that present the point of view of the LCCs. One is from, or was about Wizz Air. Another was from Fortune magazine. So James sent those in.
Of course, the airlines paid for those slots. They didn't just pluck them out of thin air. So I think that's probably why they go, hey, I'm sorry I'm not using it, but that's your problem, not mine. I just don't happen to need it right now, but I paid good money for that, especially the ones out of places like Heathrow or Charles de Gaulle or a place like that where they're god-awful expensive.
Yeah, and when they don't need them right now, as you say, it's not because of some condition that they, that they're responsible for, right? It's because of effects of the pandemic, sort of out of their hands. So anyway, different perspective. As we said, we'll have some of those articles in the show notes. You can peruse those. We also heard from Tom. He's talking about a couple of articles about shortages of pilots and shortages of astronauts.
I thought this was a story about short pilots, so that's not the case?
No.
No.
Most pilots are...
Will you stop picking on Rob again?
I know. I was going to say, most pilots seem to be kind of tall, but not all of them. From News Nation Now, U.S. expects to be short 12,000 pilots by next year. This comes from data from an Oliver Wyman study. In the U.S., projection for a shortage of 12,000 pilots by 2023. And they blame early retirement for, much of this. As an example, last year, it says roughly 18,000 Delta employees accepted buyouts and early retirement packages. So interestingly, in response to this, AvWeb has an article where Delta Airlines has announced that it's no longer going to require potential new pilots to have a college degree, which is something a little different than in the past.
I don't agree, though, that requiring a degree was discriminatory against those who have attended the School of Hard Knocks. It's like saying not being a pilot, if you wanted to be a pilot and you're not now, it's only because you don't have a license. And if you just had a license, that would be, well, that's discriminatory. They can't do that. I think that's the silliest thing I ever heard in my life.
Yeah, well, how about a doctor, right? Do you want a doctor that's got a degree, or do you want a doctor that's learned by the, quote, School of Hard Knocks? I don't think I want that doctor.
Most of my patients have lived.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, the day after Delta announced that they were no longer going to require the bachelor's degree for flight officers, and their response, by the way, was there were many qualified people that we would like to bring in, and this therefore we can bring them in. Yeah, some of us were speculating that, well, this is because they're having trouble hiring pilots, that they're lowering the requirements. A day later, after they put that story out, another story came out that says Delta Airlines has trimmed regional flying by as much as 25% for the first half of this year because of a pilot shortage. So it went on to say they expect to add 100 to 200 pilots a month throughout this year.
So the other issue here that Tom points out is concerning astronauts. NASA thinks they may need a lot more astronauts than they have now. We have this Artemis program looking to return humans to the moon. And then we have thoughts about going on to Mars. But the number of astronauts in the program is really dropped. There's an OIG report that says that in 2000, there was a peak of nearly 150 astronauts. But that's dropped down both with the at the end of the shuttle missions in 2011, and we've gone from 150 astronauts to 44, which is about almost as low as it's ever been. So if you have aspirations to be a pilot or an astronaut, there might be some opportunities.
I wonder if they get a hiring bonus.
And keep in mind, you do not need to be a pilot to be an astronaut.
Yeah, not anymore. All right. Well, thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We really appreciate it. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to go to the show notes, the shortcut is airplanegeeks.com/687. And our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we welcome your thoughts, your praise, your criticism, whatever you'd like to tell us about. So, Rob Mark, where do we find you?
They find me at, let's see, where do they find me? Well, I'm right here. I mean, you can see me. What do you mean, where do they find me? Oh, I see. They don't know where that is. They'll find me at jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter and Instagram and all that stuff, and also in the pages of Business and Commercial Aviation magazine.
Very good. David Vanderhoof.
You can find me hanging out in the TFR zone for President Biden, or you can find me hanging out at, if you can spell Vanderhoof on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, on that show called the UAV Digest that takes place on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones. We haven't mentioned that in a while. And last but not least, on our Slack listener team, and you do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com.
All right. Thank you. Max Trescott.
Oh, I just have to put out these short bragging rights. Aviation News Talk was listed number one on Apple charts for most of last week. So that's kind of kind of fun to see that. So if you're interested in general aviation and you haven't checked out the show, come on over to Aviation News Talk, and you can always shoot me an email by going to aviationnewstalk.com and click on contact at the top of the page.
Terrific. And you can find me in a lot of places. You can find all those places at 30,000feet.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Nighty night.
And thanks for listening.